Hello. This podcast is available unedited and ad-free at patreon.com/HamiltonMorris. Each month, I release 3 to 4 new podcasts, and it was Patreon exclusive until recently. Many people contacted me and said they wanted me to figure out a way to make it freely available, and so I decided to accept sponsorship from a few of my friends. One of them is David Rentlin, the founder of a company called Lucy Nicotine. They make nicotine gum, nicotine pouches, nicotine lozenges, some of which are made with synthetic nicotine, which I think is pretty cool. Now, if you don't already use nicotine, I recommend that you don't start. It's habit forming. But if you already do use nicotine products, and especially if you smoke tobacco cigarettes, I can say that this is a cleaner product. And it's also a product that I use personally. If you go to lucy.co and use the code Hamilton, you get 20% off your purchase. This podcast is also brought to you by MindCure, a Canadian life sciences company producing synthetic ibogaine that is also engaged in psychedelic research with MDMA. They're doing some cool work, and I'm on their board of advisors. Lastly, this podcast is brought to you by Top Tree Herbs, an herbal tea company founded by my friend and pharmacopoeia producer, Soren Shade. This is not a traditional sponsorship in that I'm not receiving any money from them, but Soren is actually a producer on this podcast. They grow their own kratom domestically in Appalachia in a greenhouse, which is very beautiful, and they source leaves internationally, do third-party testing. I've been to the lab where they do the testing. They test for heavy metals and other adulterants, and it's ethically sourced in tea bag form. You can find their teas at toptreeherbs.com.
My involvement started when I was like just walking down the street, you know what I mean? I was like 19 years old or whatever. So it was around 69 or 70. And this guy came up to me and said, "We have this new product and I have a whole shitload of it. I want to give away as a publicity thing. Check it out." And he showed me the clear light. And then, you know, for the next month or something, I just went around and gave away as much of it as I could. To great effect, you know what I mean? The things that impressed me about the manufacturer was how important it was, at least in the facility I showed. And that was the second place. There was another place also, a lab previous to that, was the air filtration. You know, and because it had to be like a clean room, like with working with computer stuff, you know. And so, like, because he didn't want any dust or dirt to get into it, because, you know, it was like so thin and clear, so it had to be like a really clean room. You know, the other thing was when the facility was shut down, when we shut it down and moved, wow, the amount of money I had to, I freaked out that somebody would come along, because we moved out of that place, that somebody would come along and get stoned, you know, from anything that was residual left behind. So it was like, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars. I had 3 different crews come in and completely clean the place to where you could, you know, eat off the floor. And then I did it again, you know what I mean? And again, to make sure, because I just had nightmares about what if some little kid touches someplace on the wall, you know what I mean? Where there was something there.
Wow.
You know, ultimately, you know, the thing was that the forces of commercialism in the LSD world really destroyed Clear Light. I mean, there were a lot of people that liked it and bought it, but the run-of-the-mill dealer, you know what I mean, they wanted the cheapest thing where they could make the biggest profit. And my involvement, and numerous of the people I knew who were involved, it was not about profit. It wasn't about money. It was like a holy mission, you know. To the extent of if someone within the distribution network called it window pane, our orders were from the top to drop that person. Don't distribute it to them. Cut them off. If they didn't call it Clear Light, then they were not down with the, sacred part of it or what have you. No, it was all batches, because there were numerous batches, you know, of the clear light, and there were actually numerous labs. Some people made really amateur versions, and that was clear from the get-go, and that didn't fly. But even with the very best clear light, you know, some people, they didn't want to call it clear light. They didn't want to put a spiritual spin on it. And the distributors, the major big people with it, did put a spiritual spin on it. And so they were really irked when people called it window pane. But they were going, no, it's clear light. You know, the clear light of the void, blah, 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 blah. And so they, you know, instructed us, if somebody calls it window pane, or you catch somebody selling it and calling it window pane, cut that person off. You know what I mean? We're on a trip. You know what I mean? One of the person who approached me on the street, who was in with, you know, the people who were doing the synthesis, that guy, he ended up being thrown out of the organization because he went and bought, he made money. He was in it for the money, and he went and bought a bunch of sports cars. And they told him, no, you can't have any more of our product. This is not about sports cars. You know what I mean? You know, if you want to splurge and buy a small statue of a Buddha, you can do that. You know what I mean? But you can't drive out on the road with, you know, the, you know, sports cars. You know, the story, of course, that I tell with it, you know, that to me was the big deal with Steve Jobs, you know what I mean, who, you know, took one look at the, I showed him, you know, he came over because they were like, he was selling the blue boxes, you know, at the drug dealer, so that you could use a payphone without paying. But he was also there to score acid. And so, like, you know, to impress this young guy, I showed him, you know, the wooden boxes with the 40 little glass bottles, you know what I mean? Plastic, actually. And I showed it to him. His eyes bugged out of his head. I said, you know, the regular grams of commercial tabs are around 500, although sometimes we've got it as cheap as 300 for 4,000 tablets. You know what I mean? The orange sunshine was 800 for 4,000. But the clear light was, you know, 1,200 to 1,500 for 4,000. So it was selling for triple the same dose in a pill form. And he saw, you know what I mean, like, this fascinated, the packaging was what allowed the people to sell it for triple the price. You know what I mean? Steve Jobs not only really loved clear light, you know what I mean, and mentioned that in his Department of Defense interview, but he, you know, he was totally taken, you know, the look on his face was, to me, unforgettable. And I do think that it had to do with how he later marketed, you know, the Apple products was like, you know, his eyes bugged out of his head, you know what I mean? He was like, what? You know, I mean, there was a mountain of tablets on the table, and then right beside it, I set the little box of that. And I said, this, check this out, you know.
Wow, like, that's amazing.
You know, he, of course, you know, would have been one of the people, if he had kept on coming around, that would have gotten to 86, because he was into money. You know what I mean? He would have ended up calling it window pane. Well, maybe not. He went to India, so maybe he would have maintained the spiritual, you know, thing with it. I think he wanted to make money, you know, especially like trying to sell the blue boxes, you know, that Wozniak, I believe, was making them. But he, you know, but no, I think he was paranoid of going to jail. You know what I mean? Straight right. up. I mean, because the heat was, you know, everywhere. You know, he also, I believe, if I recall correctly, he was there when Jack Leary was hanging out with too, because some of the crystal aesthetics being, we were getting it, which was the sunshine crystal that Scully and Sand were producing. But like, you know, Jack Leary was who, Tim Leary's son, was who was selling me the crystal, the sunshine crystal. And Jobs saw that Leary's son was at the apartment. And at that time, you know, Leary was very controversial. I believe that was after he had been sprung from jail. And so, like, Jobs freaked out, you know what I mean? Because he saw how much heat that was. In fact, I was paranoid as hell, too, you know what I mean? Because I happened to have been a fugitive at the time. was like the Wild West in Berkeley. But I mean, it's hard for people to understand how much LSD there was. I mean, there was just really a lot. You know, you would go to somebody's house and they would have a 50-gallon barrel filled with tablets. You know what I mean? Like millions. You know, like you go and there was like, you know, I lived in this building and on the top floor was a professor. You know what I mean? He ran a tabling machine. You know what I mean? And then underneath him was the distributor, and then basically the retailer. You know, at that point, retail was like, you know, a minimum of 10,000 doses. You know what I mean? That was considered retail. Really, it was overproduced. Basically, is what happened. I think. You know what I mean? Like it was like, you know, I mean, in a typical week, I would be, you know, offered 100 different types of tablets.
Did you ever see it being synthesized?
No, I did not. I avoided all synthesis facilities. You know what I mean? Although, you know, I supplied a lot of ergotamine tartrate to people. Some of it came from Jack Leary. That made me be able to get a good price on product. You know, I didn't supply any ergotamine tartrate to the clear-like people, though, I don't think. But you never knew who you're selling it to, you know what I mean? The politics of it were really, really intense. The thing that really did blow my mind was one time I was getting ergotamine tartrate from Jack Leary, and Leary says to me, I say to him, like, we're in the apartment, this is in the very early 70s, and I said, you know, what's the shelf life of LSD? You know, I was asking about the shelf life of ergotamine tartrate, and then I was asking about the shelf life. How long was the LSD good for? And Jackie, he said, 5 years. And I'll never forget, both of us fell on the floor. We were laughing so hard. We fell on the floor because in our heads, like 5 years was so far in the future, so impossible to imagine. You know what I mean? Like, it'll last for 5 years. It would be like saying, oh, it'll last for 5,000 years. You know what I mean? We were convinced that the whole U.S. society would collapse, that we would win, that we would overwhelm them because we had so much acid. You know, I mean, they were just like, really a lot of it. I think a recent interview, relatively recent, that Henrik Dahl did with Tim Scully. Tim Scully said, you know, about how that was what he thought too, that we would be able to overwhelm the forces of evil with the forces of LSD light. But really, it's just a non-specific amplifier. You know what I mean? The people I knew who were, you know, young, well-fed 60s people had very different trips from people who were like, you know, assholes, because assholes just had asshole trips. I mean, it just amplified whatever it was. I didn't get that was what the phenomenon was. It was just amplification until a few people that were Jesus freaks, we tried to get them to stop being religious. And, you know, how will you take, you know, this 2,000 microgram dose with us and still tell us that you believe in Jesus? And because we were sure we'd be able to get that nonsense right out of their heads. But people who do have that Christian delusion, and it is a delusion, their delusion strengthened, was what we saw. Was it didn't stop them from believing this bizarre stuff. It, you know, they came out of that, of a, you know, 2,000 microgram experience. Yeah, they puked, and yeah, we held them in our arms, and they went through a rebirth, but the rebirth was about Jesus, you know? And we didn't know that. We thought that it would change every single thing, you know what I mean? But one thing I would say, since you're researching the chemistry of it, is like, you know, I also, not only did I, you know, I was not only involved in the production of clear light and other forms of gelatin doses and tableting machines and many, many, many millions of sheets of blotter put out, you know. But I had access and examined, like, you know, hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of batches of crystal LSD. And the thing that was so striking was that, you know, you would get stuff that was like black, except if you looked at it from a very thin piece of it, it would be like purple. And you got stuff that was gray, and you got stuff that was mixed. Every color of the rainbow, shape, form, and fashion of crystal, which, you know, when you did it out, was in fact very potent. But what I saw was that what the physical appearance of the crystal LSD or the glompy black liquid or whatever you got it as had nothing to do with goodness of the trips that people had. You know what I mean? If it was white separated crystal, you know, and you looked at it in a microscope and you saw that it was, the crystals were all the same and so on and so forth, yeah, you could get more doses out of that. You know, you could make 25 microgram doses, and people did. And then it went right down the line, you know what I mean? And people didn't have as good a trips. Whereas if somebody was like, you know, the clear light experience, it was very different. You know what I mean? Like, I'll never forget, I went in Berkeley when I was giving out the samples to people, and I went to the health food store. It's still there. It was an herb store called Loss of Karnak. And I went there, and I was buying a bunch of gelatin capsules from the herb store, and the guy said, well, bring me back some of, you know, what's going in those capsules, because he thought it was some sort of organic psychedelic. And I said, okay. And then I came back and I said, well, you know, it's acid going in the capsules. And he goes, well, I'm not interested in acid. I only do organic psychedelics, you know? And I said, well, okay. And I showed him the hits of the clear light, and he said, put it in my mouth. You know what I mean? It's like, I like when, once in the early 70s also, or mid 70s, I believe, or maybe it was the 80s, I can't remember. But anyway, like Albert Hoffman came and he spoke in Berkeley in a small, very small club on San Pablo Avenue called Shared Visions. There's a recording of that. And one of Will Mofke was the DJ for it. But anyway, there was like maybe 30 people there. I was astounded at how the small number of people. And one person asked Hoffman something about blah, 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 blah. Well, what about organic psychedelics as opposed to LSD? And he sort of, it was the only time where he betrayed any negative emotions. Hoffman said, LSD is an organic psychedelic. You know what I mean? He said, it's organic chemistry. Which was, you know, telling, I thought.
True. That's amazing. And so where were you getting, you said from Jack Leary, but where did ergosamine tartrate come from at that time?
Leary, Jackie Leary was also a source of ergosamine tartrate. There was, at one point in the mid to late 70s into like the early 80s, you know, sometime between, I don't know, 77 to 82 or 83, right in that period, there was like a tidal wave of ergotamine tartrate. You know what I mean? I was amazed. And junkie, you would go to some guy's house that was a junkie, and he would have like a half a pound of ergotamine tartrate. You know what I mean? It done up in ounces as if it were pot in sandwich bags. You know what I mean? Like the guy opens a drawer and he's got all this ergotamine tartrate in sandwich bags. The last time that I moved any, it came from Arinda, a source of mine in Arinda, who is now dead. His name was he was slain in a robbery about 15 years or 20 years ago. But not a drug robbery, just some asshole robbed him and slew him execution style. But at any rate, at one point in the late 80s or whatever, I was getting ergotamine tartrate from him and in Arinda. And he had two different types. One type was from Czechoslovakia. People really wanted Czechoslovakian ergotamine tartrate. I couldn't tell the difference. You know, it's just that's what they're telling me. You know what I mean? But the situation was such that, and it's the trust that you don't see in any other drug scenes, as far as I can tell, was like, you know, I go and somebody you know, fronts me a couple of pounds if it's got any tartrate. You know what I mean? What they wanted was a certain percentage of the LSD produced. And so I took it and gave it to my other, fronted it to my other, the guy fronted me that got me in tartrate, and then I fronted it to my other friend who, you know, fronted it to his person. Judging by how fast they synthesized it and got it back, and I knew it was somewhere in Berkeley, within a few blocks of my person's house was where they were doing the work. It was being done here because whatever, but it blew my mind was that, you know, the first time when they brought me the product, they brought me something like 200 grams of crystal LSD, and it was folded in a piece of newspaper. Okay. They bring me a piece of newspaper, a sheet of newsprint newspaper with like, you know, almost a half a pound of LSD. You know, not a glass jar, not anything with, you know, what you would expect with silica gel inside another container to keep it all away from the moisture and so on and so forth. They just sort of, they were as if it were weed or something. You know what I mean? People thought that that batch was too clean. You know what I mean? They tableted it out at like 50 micrograms, and people didn't think it was strong enough. They were pissed, you know. They made it into purple microdots. But you know, people were very guarded about where the ergotamine tartrate came from. Another person, his name was I forget what his name was, but he got it from South Africa. Was his name, and he was a very huge dealer in Berkeley. From the related to H.L. Mencken, from that family, and he was a heroin addict. But you know, he somehow established a connection in South Africa, or so he said, and got it there. I knew other people who got it from cocaine dealers, basically, who got it in Honduras. They got caught with it too in Miami. They let them go, or else they worked with the DEA after that, or I don't know what. You know what I mean? Most of the time when I was doing all this stuff, I was a federal fugitive because I was arrested in early 1972 with sales of MDA. And that was prior to there being a DEA. It was the BNDD, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. And then they were totally brutal. I mean, they beat me really badly, and then they told me if I didn't cooperate, they would have me killed and in prison. And I thought, but they let me go on bail, and I moved to Mexico City. But I can only stay there so long, you know, and so I came back. And, you know, a sales pitch that I used in my work, because basically I wasn't a drug dealer. I was part of, like, quality control, you know what I mean? I could come in and, you know, tablet out your product, or, you know, I am not a, you know, synthesist. I'm not a chemist, but I had enough chemical knowledge to be able to clean up things. In other words, I could buy dark colored crystal LSD from one person, and I could make it look different and sell it to another person. Do you know what I mean? And so on and so forth. Because the intrigues were really sick. Everybody, you know, most of the people that I moved product to or worked with knew the other people that I'm working with, but you can't say who you got something from. You know what I mean? I get the ergotamine tartrate from one person, I give it to the other person. The person that I'm giving it to, you know, the ergotamine tartrate came from their connection. You know what I mean? But their connection doesn't want them, that person, to know that they're moving ergotamine tartrate, et cetera, et cetera. But people, because I was a fugitive, I would say to people, my tagline was, if I'm at your house, you're safe. You know what I mean? Because I'm not going anyplace near any cops, because they already beat the shit out of me and have threatened me with, you know, going to jail forever. Eventually, they caught me, you know, in 1985. And I was in Oakland on College Avenue, and I was using a payphone. You know what I mean? I had a briefcase that had every kind of drug you can imagine in there, including 2CB with a diagrams from the chemist who synthesized it, and it was explaining to me what it was. You know what I mean? All this ecstasy that came from a guy who was my friend, a chemist who was arrested at the largest, in 2009, he was arrested at the largest ecstasy lab ever seized in California, with a shitload of money and everything. But I had all these things in this briefcase, and I was at the payphone, and I was sitting, and I'd been at that point a federal fugitive for 13 years. But I had a lot of dope in there, man, a lot of LSD, a lot of everything. And I'm using the payphone to, you know, call up. I was at the time living in this mansion up in the Oakland Hills with these coke smuggler guy and pilot. And the and I'm standing there using the phone, and this guy comes up and he puts a gun to my head. It was so big you couldn't imagine. He said, clandestine laboratory task force, what's your name? And, you know, I had just had a new set of fake ID printed up and new business cards under that fake name. And I said, Frederick William, the first time in my life, because I had lots of close calls and always smoothied my way right through it with fake ID. I couldn't remember the fake name I was using. And the narc said to me, your name is, and he gave a list of names. It must have been 20 different names that he had committed to memory. And they were all aliases I'd used over the past 13 years. And then the next thing he said to me, he said, do you want me to take you to a hospital? And I looked at him, he said, you just turned white as a sheet. And I said, no, it's okay. Go ahead and take me to jail. You know what I mean? In the end, you know, and it was interesting, you know, they were going to, after they dropped me off at the jail, then they went on, they were talking about, they were going down to Bust Chemicals for Research and Industry, which was a major, major supplier of chemicals. They were so great. They were like this chemical company in Berkeley. And, you know, you could go there and ask them for chemicals. They knew what you were doing, and they would give you all kinds of free chemicals and stuff. Like, they were really good, but they ended up being fined $50 million and shut down. You know what I mean? At one point, it had been called Zero Waste, and then it became Chemicals for Research and Industry. I beat the NDA Bust charge, and I ended up being sentenced to 2 years in federal prison for failure to appear in court. You know what I mean? All the dope I had in the briefcase, they never charged me with it. I never understood why that was. It was fascinating being in prison. You know what I mean? Like, but I was there about a week, and it was in Arizona at Safford, which was a light security prison. It was where John Ehrlichman, the Watergate conspirator, did his time. And, you know, it was where bigwig. There was two types of prisoners, people who used boats and people who used planes, basically. But I was sitting in the chow hall, and I was adding up, you know, the amount of money at the table where I was eating was more than $1 billion worth of drugs had been seized from the people at that table. And I'm sitting there talking, and this guy, he looks over at me and he goes, Berkeley, California, 1971, Golden Hornet Crystal. And I go, what? He goes, I know you. He says, I never met you, but I bought lots of crystal LSD from you. He said, you would be in one room and I would be in the other room. He says, I recognize your voice after all these years. You know, it was 1985, so like 15 years later, which was right on, because he was the guy who had the biggest influence in the jail. He'd been in there for a long time for all these boatloads of Colombian weed. And so he ran the jail, basically, and the fact that he knew me and recognized my voice from LSD deals, you know, was right on. My lawyer, I had a free lawyer, not by the state, but my friends went in the phone book when I got busted for the in 1985, and they found a lawyer, and the lawyer told me, he said, you know, I'm taking your case, I'm taking it for free. He said, because I took LSD when I was younger and it changed my life, you know, completely. And he said, and that was like, you know, so I'll defend you. You know what I mean? So I was lucky. I agreed to take a 5-year sentence because I had the harshest judge in the federal system, Judge Samuel Conte. And he was the same people that sentenced Owsley and Scully and all these he was a real super asshole judge, and I knew he was going to give me the maximum for the failure to appear. So, like, I just said, okay, I'll take 5 years. And he refused to sentence me to 5 years. It blew my lawyer's mind. You know what I mean? I had packed the courtroom with all these women. You know, I would also say that, you know, not only, you know, did I know Jobs, but also Kerry Mullis. You know what I mean?
Oh, no way. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was amazing. In fact, he liked these blue pill acid pills. He was a super LSD user. But, you know, what is amazing? I believe he tableted, is what I heard. He didn't say anything to me about it, but I understood he was what the DEA calls conversion as opposed to synthesis, although he was completely smart enough to synthesize, no question. And, you know, the synthesis is, well, as you know, it's not that hard to do, but the thing that's really hard to do is to get a decent yield. But, like, he would hang out, and this is referenced by Susie Orman. There was a tiny restaurant in Berkeley. It was called the Buttercup Cafe. I mean, it was like the size of a bedroom. And Orman was the manager. She was an asshole to me. She was the manager. But in her recent, a few years back, TV lecture, she talked about how, oh, yeah, these guys would come in. And I remember these guys would come in, and they would, like, they were saying, can you give us free coffee? We're working on this invention that's going to change the world. And it was Steve Jobs, you know what I mean, and Wozniak. And she refused to give him coffee. She says, that was the worst decision I ever made in my life. I thought they were deadbeats, you know what I mean? But she was the waitress, the manager at this tiny place with Kerry Mullis. So you had Susie Orman, the famous financial lady. You had, you know, Steve Jobs sitting there drinking coffee, you know, 2 feet away, and you had the manager who was Kerry Mullis, you know what I mean? So it's like amazing. Somebody else was posting online about that in a history of Berkeley, and they were going, yeah, what did they put in the water at that restaurant, you know what I mean? But all the people there were really, you know, into drugs. So the owner was one of the first casualties of freebase cocaine, unfortunately. He didn't die, but I went there one day, and they had the IRS came in, and they seized the place. You know what I mean? The people's food was still on the table. They just made everybody get up and leave. So I assume he lost the restaurant. But, like, you know, yeah, it was a small world. You know, somebody else that I have taken a lot of LSD around was Jack Dorsey, the billionaire co-founder of Twitter.
Oh, wow. Huh.
When he hung out, he was a punk, and he hung out at 924 Gilman, the world famous club in Berkeley. And I lived in a van there. I was homeless. Until recently, I was homeless for 27 years, living in a van. And I lived right beside, I just camped out in my RV right beside the punk club. So I was really familiar with Dorsey, who was, you know, the doorman. He was the bouncer at the club. You know what I mean? Nobody would have ever in a million years thought that he would amount to anything. You know what I mean? He was kind of a jerk guy. And, you know, I got arrested, but I can establish that I was there when he was there because I was arrested there for failure to sign tickets. You know what I mean? Like, they came and they gave me traffic false tickets, and I refused to sign them, so they put me in jail. And I mean, the judge dismissed the charges because they were false charges and mutually they were contradicted to one another, so I couldn't have done it. But I forced them to arrest me. Somebody else that I knew well was J.B. Ryan. Do you know who that is?
No.
He was the guy who originated the term ESP, extrasensory perception. The Duke Parapsychology Lab. I lived a lot in North Carolina, and I was a ESP researcher. At one point, the government took me away from my parents in the eighth grade, and they put me in this converted hospital, educational research project funded by the Ford Foundation, amongst other people. And my project was that I studied ESP. And they gave me unlimited funding, no adult supervision, and an office. And I did all these experiments, ESP experiments, on the students there. I was very adept at hypnosis in the eighth grade. That may have been why they put me in this special school. It was like a residential school. I mean, my parents weren't allowed to go there. I lived at this place and did these ESP experiments. But because it was in very close to Duke University in the Duke Parapsychology Lab, which Ryan ran, I contacted him, and he gave me a lot of assistance and the Foundation for Research on the Nature of Man, which is the organization he ran. They helped me. I'm astounded, however, since then, to learn from Michael Horowitz, that's the actress Winona Ryder's father, who is somebody I know.
Yeah.
He has these things, these documents. He's a rare drug book dealer. I was a drug book dealer too. And, you know, these documents were from Sandoz and a representative to J.B. Ryan's lab in the 60s. You know what I mean? So he was involved secretly, Ryan, not only in the ESP stuff, but with psychedelics also. That blew my mind. You know what I mean? And letters, I believe another letter that was from Aldous Huxley to Ryan is another rare thing that Michael had. All these things are all connected. You know what I mean? I now, in retrospect, realize that, you know, that the book Acid Dreams, that there's a lot of truth in that. I agree with Scully said that too. I believe we're never going to really know what the full story was of what was going on. You know what I mean? However, I'm now wonder how I got away with what I got away with. Maybe, some people I knew were ex-military who were heavily involved. I was raised on military bases. Because my father was career military. And so until I was 14, I was on military bases. And so I gravitated toward people who had that military discipline in terms of producing and distributing LSD. And I now realize, wow, some of those military people I met who came back from Vietnam and then got introduced to me and who were big LSD traffickers, those people may have been something to do with, CIA or what have you. But you never know. You know what I mean? The moment somebody says they're CIA, you know they're not. You know what I mean? We'll never know the true story, of what happened. But I will say that the Clear Light experience was truly, truly one of the most remarkable things. You know, I never completed it, but I started writing a book called I forget what I called it, the Clear Light World or the Clear Light Experience, because I thought, wow, civilization's going to collapse and we can use this clear light as currency. And I envisioned it as being the money of the future. You know what I mean? The early history of clear light, by the way, was that it came, the first stuff that I got was four times larger than the hits, than most hits. The initial stuff that they produced, I believe it was coming out of Santa Cruz, a lab there, came in these white plastic boxes. And then after that, they made the hits smaller, but this, of the same potency, of the standard size, like a tenth of an inch by a tenth of an inch of the clear light hits. And it came in sections of surgical tubing that were sealed. You know, once I was carrying some in my mouth because I thought the police were going to bust me, and I had this taste in my mouth. I thought it had leaked. I thought, oh, my God, it did. You know what I mean? But then it ended up being in those little boxes. But, and then later, of course, I was involved in the mid-80s in the production of microdose LSD, which I never got any credit for that. I never got in any trouble for it either, but initially they were drop-ons, 5 microgram drop-ons on vitamin C tablets in sealed glass bottles that were shrink-wrapped and labeled. But then later there was blotters, and the first batch of that was 400,000 microdose doses, and it was called Clear Light Microdose. The first batch was called Clear Light brand Mind vitamin tablets. They were the vitamin C tablets, but then there was a huge batch that went out there with labeled instructions with each little, came 25 5 microgram doses, on perforated paper. Unfortunately, a large percentage of that got seized by the DEA. Apparently, somebody or friend of they said they got seized by the DEA. But still, it went out there, and people, they were pissed off. I got death threats because of microdose LSD from the LSD community. Serious. I took them serious death threats. People said to me, "Dude, you've been part of this with me for 20 years. I mean, I took LSD. You got to understand, I took LSD at least once every 48 hours for more than 20 years. I kept a written record. I took it more than 5,000 times. And people said, "Dude, you are into high dose LSD, the orange sunshine, the 300 microgram doses, not the 25 to 50 microgram commercial things. And you've always been into, we have to change people's lives. And this is, the rebirth experience and all that sort of stuff." And people said, "I risked my life. And my whole life is on this, and you too, that we would, these high doses to change people's lives and make them be better people and not go off and fight wars and not be capitalists. And you're making this stuff, these 5 microgram doses that reinforce pig people, that makes it easier to be a cop, that makes it easier to be, a capitalist. You're emphasizing and helping the bad guys by doing that. And because you're doing that, we're going to come to your house and burn it down, or we're going to kill you, or I'll cut your fucking head off." The reaction was very, very negative to the, microdose LSD. That's why I'm thrilled now, all these years later, the book by, what's her name here in Berkeley, Michael Chabon's.
Eilat Waltman or whatever.
Yeah, I'm glad, that people are now seeing the value of it, because I saw a great value. The instructions that I gave people were, fast for 3 days, blah, 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 and take it, and if you will have a good and wonderful experience. But I never get any credit. I read all these books about microdose and all this, press on it, and a lot in Silicon Valley. None of them seem to recognize that. For years and years, there was lots of microdose LSD on the streets. It just never was a sellable thing. I made it. I gave it away. I never sold a dose of it. I made, really a lot, and just gave it away, thinking that it would make the world a better place. Maybe it did. We're all still here. My girlfriend, who was a psychiatric nurse, her son was having difficulties, and he had taken acid, did not make the problem better. It made it worse. And I don't know if it was autistic or what the thing was, but at any rate, she and my friend said to her, he said, "Yeah, some people can't handle LSD. And it causes them to have bad trips." Scully talked about that too. He felt remorse. But he said, some people have a bad trip. And he said, "And we need to eliminate anybody who cannot handle LSD." He says, "We need to purify the gene pool." And that's why all these years I produced so many millions of doses and distributed them, is I want to purify the gene pool by driving crazy anybody who is latently, schizophrenic or what have you. And I refused to have anything further to do with the person after he told me that. I was like, that is so fucking Nazi. The guy was very fluent in German, and he was a really Nazi kind of guy, but I didn't get that he, thought LSD was a great tool for purifying the gene pool. Scully wasn't reacted the same way I did when I told him about that. He said, "That is horrific. That's one of the most horrific things I've ever heard." I said, "Yeah, what can you do? All those years you thought the person was a good guy, and he, wasn't. He wanted to harm people, or that was in his mind."
Wow, eugenic psychedelia. I've never even thought of that.
Yeah, he just, and I was so shocked when he said it to my girlfriend, who was like freaking out about her son. And he's going, "Well, if he can't handle it, then he should either commit suicide or be institutionalized. We need to get rid of these people. We don't need them." Oh, man, you're saying this to a mother who's freaking out over her son? you're a fucking monster, you know. It's like, you know, but you could see that you know, that some people did think that, apparently, you know what I mean? You saw it on the street level, you know what I mean, where people were like macho about it. I can handle acid and you can't handle acid and I'll steal your old lady and so on and so forth, you know what I mean? But you never, you know, I never dreamed that somebody at a large scale level would think, yeah, you know what I mean, we can euthanize it. And it, you know, and that person was not a bad person for a long time. I mean, he was my partner, and you know, whenever we didn't money, we thought really was sorted when it came to LSD, a sorted thing that shouldn't be associated. So, you know, if we made money, and sometimes it would be thousands upon thousands of dollars, we always tried to have a house that had a fireplace because we just burnt all the money. You know what I mean? We'd, you know, good $100 bills make excellent kindling. You know, you just put them in the fireplace and burn them all up. You know what I mean? We did not do anything wrong today. You know what I mean? Unfortunately, our girlfriends got together and said, we're not going to be with you anymore if you keep burning all the money. You know what I mean? Like, but to me, it made sense. And I, you know, that somebody who was seemingly that pure in their motivation, that they should come to the conclusion that they use it, we're going to use it for, you know, to purify the gene pool, was too much for me. You know what I mean? But one thing I wrote down some brief notes here, you know, but the one thing that I wanted to mention was that what I liked doing, in particular with gel forms of LSD, I made ones that were like, they were like clear light, but they were colored. One of them was gray. But what I liked doing was like saving all different batches of crystal and then like making ones for like one. It was like 14 different batches of LSD crystal. And then, you know, mix them in the hit so that somebody would have a full body thing. You know what I mean? 14 types of LSD in one dose, which to me was like a unique thing. You know what I mean? But I don't think people got it. You know what I mean? It's like Tim said, it's set and setting, not, you know, pharmacology. I will say this, though, as a somewhat silly sounding aside, but if there is an element of seriousness, is I also was, you know, extremely obsessed with the same thing. I wanted to see it synthesized. I wanted to go into a lab and so on and so forth. At some point, I was really terrified to be anywhere near that. But eventually, I wanted that. And because it was so impossible to come by that information, I became convinced, well, maybe it comes from off-planet. It comes from aliens or something like that. It's not even made by human beings. I mean, that sounds silly, but it was such an incredible impossibility of finding a photograph, you know, of an operating lab that you could actually see. I could read all the descriptions of how to synthesize it, you know what I mean? But I wanted, with my own eyes, to see that happen and then take the product. And I never did get to see that, you know what I mean? But I don't believe it comes from flying saucers anymore. And I never did, really. But a few times I was like, well, what other possible reason? There's got to be somebody who would have let the cat out of the bag. Somebody, somewhere. You know what I mean? And by the way, I really like that Lemire film. That was like great. That is really great, the lab, you know what I mean? And I will say, you know, what I said to Tim recently, which was Casey Hardison. I was at a show where I was doing security, and it was a crowded Grateful Dead event. And he came in, you know, I don't know him, but I knew what he looked like. And he was somebody I really wanted to talk to. And so, like, he came in, and he was in a crowded room. I mean, there was like 300 people in that room dancing and tripping balls. And I looked across the room at him. He saw me see him. He got out of there. I must have climbed out of a window at the back of the venue or something. I don't know how he got away. I never got to speak to him. But I went, wow, that guy is incredibly, incredibly sharp. You know what I mean? Hardison, damn, his mind is like a, you know, wow, super perceptive. That he saw just by the look on my face, clear across through that many people, I mean, I'm speculating, but I think it's pretty clear that that was what it was. I looked and I went, wow, that's the guy I want to talk to. And he was gone. I'm sorry about his story. He's like a lot of people. He was eager. You know what I mean? You got to understand, these narcs are, believe me, they beat the shit out of me, man. And they kicked me in the balls until I was puking. And then they said, what are you doing on the floor puking, messing up our, and we told you to stand up when you talk to us. So they kicked me in the balls until I stood up. And then they said, well, I told you to be on the floor. And then they kicked me in the balls until I was on the floor. You know what I mean? Puking, et cetera. Like, these people, you get these, I, more than anything in the world, I hate marijuana. I think it should be mandatory capital punishment for a single use of marijuana. And you get these cops. That's their thing, man. Like, wow. Like, so I understand why it's really difficult to find a functioning lab and photograph what's going on.
Because
people realize that, should you be caught with an LSD lab, you are in fact facing life. No possibility of parole. You know what I mean? That's a serious thing. You know what I mean? Me and all of my illegal activities, and I went, like I'm saying, I produced massive amounts of LSD over the course of many years. And I never got caught. I never had to go and kill anybody or to get away or anything like that. It was just, I always had everything packed and every lab space that I had set up, like the one in the picture you mentioned, that opened into a nature area so that if I had to escape, it was an escape route going. And it did happen, not at that place, but in numerous places where I was. I got away. The police would be coming in. They got everybody else, but I grabbed the dope and got out the back door or, across the roof or what have you. I mean, if I went and visited somebody before I spoke a word to them, I went and discovered all the escape routes, and then I would go in their apartment and speak to them. Because otherwise I saw, you're going to have to shoot somebody if you want to stay free. And I'm not willing to harm anybody. You know what I mean? I was deeply impressed in my life by Henry David Thoreau and Gandhi and all these kind of people. I'm a very nonviolent person. The thing that convinced me totally of nonviolence for all time and for my life was the first time I took LSD, and it was at a beach in Big Sur. Two orange tablets, I assume they were Scully stuff. But as I started coming on really strong, I saw this slaughter scene. You know what I mean? These people had machetes and they were chopping people up. I was having a perinatal experience, I think. You know what I mean? It's described by Stan Grof and people like that. The violence of being born, can trip people out, and they can see like violent scenes sometimes on acid trips. And that was what I saw. But it was really, it wasn't color and enhancement, and it wasn't patterns. It looked as if I was seeing a slaughter. It was at a beach, and I thought that people were like chopping people up. And really, if I had had a weapon, I might have been tempted to try to defend those people. You know what I mean? And when I realized later that that was a hallucination and it seemed so incredibly realistic, I went, well, I can never, ever be violent in my life because I may be hallucinating. You know what I mean? It made me realize that, reality is just what we, see, and so on and so forth. That, to take radical, violent action based on my sensory input was wrong. You know what I mean? That I could never be violent, and that stuck with me, forever. Unfortunately, I saw it didn't stick with other people. You know what I mean? They went right ahead. The thing that I saw that was like totally destructive, there was the LSD scene in Berkeley was so beautiful. It really was a wonderful thing in like 1969, 1970, and like that. But cocaine came in, and like that changed everything. That really, what an ugly experience it was. I mean, I was like everybody else. I liked cocaine. I got strung out of it just like everybody else. But like it made people greedy. You know what I mean? Whereas LSD is ego dystonic, you know, cocaine is ego syntonic, you know what I mean? It's the polar opposite. You know, it strengthens your ego. And that really caused people to be greedy and, you know, and it ultimately crashed the clear light scene, in my opinion. Even though people wanted to buy the cheaper product, the dealers wanted it, the public still wanted clear light. But what happened was there was a lot of counterfeits that came out, you know what I mean? One of the ones that was the weirdest counterfeit ever was people, you know, when you get a pack of cigarettes and it has like a cellophane wrapper on the pack of cigarettes.
Yeah.
And it has that little red piece of thing and you pull it and all the way around the top of the pack, and then you can open the cellophane, you know, it's like a sort of a zipper like thing. That yeah. little piece of, people took that cause it was the same width as a hit of clear light. And they would cut that into pieces that looked like clear light. You know what I mean? It was from cigarette packs and they would sell it on the street. You know what I mean? But like other people, you know, they just like, you know, they were, the other thing that caused a real problem was that up until, you know, the mid 70s and really up until the 90s, as far as I could tell, or the late 80s, mid 80s, there wasn't much crystal LSD. You know, you could get lots of tabs and you could get clear light and you could get it in a variety of forms, but there was a real, the labs and the people producing and the, you know, the preparation of the doses did not want there to be crystal LSD go out there. And so, you know, when it became so that, you know, 17-year-old deadheads could get crystal LSD, it caused all kinds of, you know, major problems. There were a lot of, you know, cult type things out there. You know what I mean? Some of which I only, you know from pamphlets and things that I got at bookstores where people were saving LSD literature for me. But like, it really, you know, it really causes you to want to form cults. You know what I mean? I tried to avoid that completely, you know what I mean? Especially when it was directed at me, you know what I mean? Wow, will you be the head of my cult? Type of vibe from people. I'm like, no, you don't understand. That's not how I want it to be. You know what I mean? I want it to be like free thinking as opposed to some guy at the top's going to tell me what to do. You know what I mean? One thing that was weird in Berkeley was you had like, government people come, like guys in business suits, these guys in the business suits one day on the street, you know, they said, hey, we're like government chemists and we stole all of these drugs and do you want to try some of them? And they took me around the corner and they had suitcases filled with powdered drugs. And the one that they turned me onto was a diethyltryptamine, DET. I remember I was like doing Australian crawl on the sidewalk, swimming up the street after I did it. You know what I mean? The other guy had a cult in Oakland, and it was a toluene cult. And my friends got hooked into it. They got hooked into it when they were on a clear light trip, actually. And they switched bodies. They had never met each other. And then for the next 6 months, they never spoke to each other, but they just like were one unit in two different bodies. You know what I mean? They sort of weird switched bodies, but they got hooked up with this cult in Oakland and it was for toluene. And the guy had a 50-gallon barrel of it, you know, basically glucinating. And every morning my friend would take, they had a boxes and boxes of Ziploc bags and a big box of white washcloth. And he would, in front of, they had this expensive large house in Oakland, the guy that ran it, that was the cult guy. And my other friend was his lead, you know, priest. And he would dip the white washcloth in the toluene, and then he would put it in the gallon Ziploc bag, and he would hand them out to the people. And they called the washcloth soaked in the toluene the lamb. This is the lamb of the Lord. You know what I mean? And I was like, man, they came to my house. I took their washcloths from them and I threw it up on the roof. They climbed up on the roof and got it back. You know what I mean? Like, I often wonder, was that a government research project? What the hell?
You know what was,
I,
What was the name of that group?
I don't know. They never really had an official name, you know what I mean? I will say that at the North Carolina Advancement School, which is that place I was talking about where the government had me do ESP research, the thrust of my research there, I knew about LSD. I'd read about it, but I had no way to get my hands on it. It was legal at the time. So I used a glue. Specifically Sanford's rubber cement glue. And I did all these ESP tests on people after I hypnotized them, and sometimes without hypnotizing them, and had them sniff glue and do these ESP tests. You know what I mean? I had one guy who appeared to be able to influence the flight path of Estes Industries model rockets. We did all these tests to see if there was, they could psychokinetically, cause a rocket to go to one side or the other. And he appeared to have that. And I had another person who, with the Zener card test, which has like five different symbols. It's a standard ESP test. And there's 25 cards, five of each. And the person tries to guess, is it a wavy line, a heart, a circle, you know, and there were these five symbols. And I had a guy who, in his normal, I kept, as I would have them guess the run of the cards, I would write down what they guessed each card was. And most people, it was just chance, you know what I mean? But I kept a record of each time that they did it. You know what I mean? I would test them like 20 times in a row. And I had one guy when I went back, and he was guessing three runs ahead. And he was guessing sometimes with 100% accuracy. In other words, he was guessing three shuffles down the road and was guessing 100% accurate, according to my crude eighth grade, not so scientific research, you know what I mean? But since then, you know, it's something I regret in some ways, because I've thought if the government got those results, and they were already hanging out with Ryan, and so they had to do parapsychology labs, so they probably did know about my results. And if somebody could influence the flight of a model rocket, and if somebody could guess the order of the cards with 100% accuracy before they were shuffled, even though my test was not nearly scientifically rigorous, if the government heard that, I'm afraid they went and took those people away from their parents, and they, you know what I mean? They're telling what happened to them. You know what I mean? The government would not be nice if they thought you could influence the flight of a rocket. You know what I mean? So I have, you know, but it was interesting that the glue, the toluene basically, and so on and so forth, that I perceived that, you know, might influence psychic phenomena. It's because I had read that book by Cavana and Servadio, Experiments with LSD 25 and Psilocybin or something like that. It was like a 1964 book, I believe. Yeah, I had to steal a copy from a medical library to get my copy. It's the only book I ever stole. I wanted that book so bad. Oh, well. In my lifetime, according to the IRS, my entire lifetime, I'm approaching 70. My entire lifetime earnings is $2,143. In more than 50 years, that was how much money I made. You know what I mean? I, of course, you know, in my not career of nonprofit quality control, because that's how I thought of myself in the LSD scene, people paid my bills. You know what I mean? That was what I worked for. If you pay my rent, I'll, you know, package this for you, or I'll tablet this out for you, and so on and so forth. But it meant that, anything that I have, I had to put in storage because I was homeless, like I'm saying, for 27 years. The only reason I'm not homeless now is I had a stroke in December. And so now I'm in a old folks dying home. Yeah, you know, I want to say that was one of the, aside from LSD, that was one of the most awesome experiences in my life. I'm sitting at the library, you know what I mean, which is like 30 seconds away from an ambulance, and that's why I went to this library every day for 10 years and went online. And so because it was close to an ambulance, and in case I needed something. And sure enough, in December, I was sitting there, and suddenly, I couldn't send an email. I couldn't make the cursor go and click on send, and I couldn't speak, and then I completely lost control of my body. I couldn't move either my arms or my legs, and I couldn't speak. And it happened in the space of like 10 seconds. If I had been driving, oh my God, I would have been toast. You know what I mean? And so would have a lot of other people. If I had been in the panel van where I've been living for all those years, they would have never found me because I'm a very paranoid person who, you know, hides out in their van, and people that know me have instructions never to come near my van. So it would have been really, really drastic. They rushed me to the emergency room because the ambulance was right there. They came instant. People at their library, they saw half of my body was drooped, you know what I mean? And they saw, oh my God, it's a classic stroke. And they called the ambulance. The ambulance rushed me to the hospital, and they set me up with TPA. From Genentech, the technology. And it dissolved the blood clot in my brain, and apparently I've recovered fully with, you know, negative effects, but that can no longer be a homeless person like I did for the past 27 years and sleep in the alleyways and vans and things because of that stroke. I realized I'll be dead, you know what I mean? So now I'm in this really horrific old folks home where they do not believe that there is any such thing as the coronavirus. They believe it's a hoax.
Oh, man.
And so the people who are preparing the food here, you know, they're coughing their guts out every day, and they're preparing the food. They don't wear face masks. You know what I mean? You know, two blocks away, they just keep, 59 people just came down with the COVID virus. Six of them died. You know what I mean? This with inside of where I am in a similar facility, so I'm assuming. In fact, on Facebook, if you go to my Facebook page, I've been, and I'll say it to you, saying my goodbyes to people because I think I will probably get it. And because of my age, I will probably die. Or there's a good chance of that. But with sadness, I'm, you know, saying goodbye to everybody. I would say to you, keep up the good work. You know what I mean?
Well, take care of yourself. I'm really sorry to hear about your circumstances.
Yeah, it's really scary. You know what I mean? It is one of the scariest things because I know what to do to not get this. And I can't get people to, you know, I mean, people are threatening my life. What do you mean? I can't come within 6 feet of you. You're a racist prick. How dare you tell me you blah, blah, blah. And, you know, coming over and rubbing their face and then putting their hand and rubbing my face. And people are really, wow. You know what I mean? Like, it's incredible. This is the whole facility is filled with people who are mentally ill, severely. I'm not mentally ill. But if I talk to my doctors or me, the medical people, the moment I tell somebody I took LSD 5,000 times, nothing I say after that will they listen to.
You know? maybe it's better to keep that to yourself. Although I, of course, understand that it's, you know, to people that know, it's, if anything, a sign of your sanity.
Yeah, you know what I mean? You know, but I had not realized that the fear of LSD is still that strong.
And this is maybe an odd question to ask so late in the conversation, but what is your name?
I'm not going to give out my name.
Okay.
I use the two names that I use are JDYF 333. That's my online, you know, name. And David Rose is the other one. If, you know, I give enough information on Flickr and enough information in this blog that if a person was the man, you know what I mean, they could figure out who I am. You know, I give my, you know, date of birth and stuff like that. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't want to, I'm not trying to hide so much from the cops as my family members. You understand that, like, I came from a very conservative family, and there's only one of my family, immediate family, still left alive. But my dad was, like, you know, a KKK guy and a real Nazi type bastard, you know what I mean, who beat me and threw me out and so on and so forth. So I, you know, kept my identity secret because I didn't want there to be blowback on my family. It's not that I don't trust people and so on and so forth. You know, suffice it to say, as I say in the autobiography, are you familiar with the Andy Griffith Show, Mayberry and all that sort of stuff?
Only the name. I've never seen it.
You're a pure soul, and you're lucky. Don't see it, and your life will be better. Anyway, I come from the straightest redneck. My grandmother was, Andy Griffith's Sunday school teacher, and so on and so forth. Moonshiners from Mount Airy, North Carolina, which was the fictional Mayberry on television all those years with these programs with this sheriff guy. That's who, Andy Griffith's show is. But in other words, a very straight background. And so I have kept my, identity secret. You know what I mean? That was my total shock when the cop went down the list and named every name I'd ever used. You know what I mean? Most of them they apparently got from Western Union. But it used to be you could send money and you didn't have to show ID to pick it up. There was just a test question. In my case, it was, how many days are in the week? 21 was the answer. And if you said 21, then the Western Union people would give you the money. So I was able to transfer funds all over the country, all over the world, without having to use a name, so on and so forth. And so, I got away with it. Plus, I was adamantly against the war. And I still, to this day, do not know what warrants are out for my arrest. There probably are relating to anti-war activities, although I'm not really a destructive person. I also did not like the war machine, you know what I mean, and was extremely pissed off about the draft. You know what I mean? I'll dedicate my life to stopping you motherfuckers, I wrote to them, you know what I mean? Please come and arrest me, but first you're going to have to find me. That was my shock when the guy knew all my name, all of my... But the weirdest thing, I will say this about that as a aside, was when he said all those different names, the NARC, when the clandestine laboratory task force guy, when he said that, I was freaked the fuck out. And he tells me all those names. And then they took me over to the federal building in San Francisco, and they said, your name is this. And the name that they thought I wasn't my real name. Okay. It was an alias. And I said, well, that's not my real name, because I knew the gig was up, you know what I mean? And so I was like, this is my real name, and I told them my real name. And they said, we know where your daughter is, and, we're going to go to her elementary school, and we're going to take her away, and you'll never see your daughter again if you lie to us again about your name. And so they insisted that my name was an alias. They threatened my daughter. They would say, if I didn't say that my name was the alias, of course, the fingerprints came back and they did go, oh, well, that really is your name. You know what I mean? But even then, it was so weird, man. They put me in, I did the 2 years in prison, and they or 15 months actually, they used the wrong name in prison, my name, and they mixed it up. And so, and I said, but that's not my name. And they said, sorry, once the prison system says that's your name, it becomes your name. So, you know what I mean? I said, but I'm here for failure to appear in court. And you never told that person to go to court. You know what I mean? How can that be? You know what I mean? And it's interesting because the judge who sentenced me to the 2 years, when they caught Nick Sand there in Canada and they brought him back to that same judge and they were charging him with failure to appear. And it was the same judge, Conti, as me. He said, his lawyer said, prove that you told him to come to court. And they couldn't. And so they dismissed that. You know what I mean? He beat the thing I went to prison for because they couldn't prove, but I didn't have the opportunity to do that. You know what I mean? And I was glad because I didn't want to. I was facing 40 years for the MDA charge. And, because of the Speedy Trial Act, what happened was it had been 13 years before, and they microfilmed the details of the case and sent them to the East Coast. And my lawyer demanded a speedy trial, and they couldn't find the records. So apparently they dismissed those charges and just sentenced me on the failure to appear in court type of thing, which I could have beat. Like I'm saying, it seems like I could have beat it, but my lawyer was just like, let's let it go at that. And I'm like, okay. But one thing I did learn is you don't want this to ever happen to you. You don't want to ever be charged with a felony because, man, that slams all these doors closed. It's incredible. My life, because I got that felony conviction, it's a felony to not appear in court to face charges that you weren't found guilty of. Because that's what it was. I went to prison for failure to appear to face charges that I wasn't found guilty of. You know what I mean? Some cops said, wow, that's so sad, including the warden in the prison. He says, you don't belong here. I'm going, I know. He says, you're your typical Berkeley guy. You took that LSD and you think you can change the world. I said, I did. He said, you don't belong here, but oh, well. Okay. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time. And I hope, and please stay safe. And I hope you, you make it through all this.
Yes. But even if I don't, I've had a good run and I'm really happy about that and so on and so forth. And thank you for the work you're doing. Really, it's extremely, extremely, extremely important that people learn about this and know about this. If nothing else, it's for the, you know, the Darren Lemaires and people like that out there. The one in a million, one in a 10,000 people who will pick up on this information and use it right on in a good way. You know what I mean? So they're like, yeah, I don't like religion, so I'm not going to call it a holy mission, but, you know, pretty damn close. Okay.
All right. Have a good night. Thank you so much.
Shalom.